It's time for the Picture House Podcast with your hosts, Sam and Simon. Please ensure that your mobile phone is switched off, refrain from smoking, and keep conversation to a minimum. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show!
Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Nick. Pleasure to have you
it's
on the
pleasure.
Show. I'm surprised we haven't had you on the show before.
It's great to be with you, and I really enjoyed going to Clapham yesterday, doing the... I guess it was a pre-screening talk.
Absolutely, yes.
And it was fun. And it was really nice to meet an audience and to hear what they've got to say and deal with some of their funny questions, some of them which are quite difficult. But it's always interesting.
I think with... you do this with a lot of your films because you often play at film festivals where they have the filmmaker talk and the Q&A.
Yeah.
And, of course, on Sunday night, you had the big live premiere, which was satellited out to many cinemas across the country, including ours. What's that sort of like when you're touring around with a film and you're actually there in person to meet the audience?
Well, first of all, it's fantastic as a filmmaker to feel that your work's getting out there. That is just forgetting the fact that you're answering the same question hundreds of times and you feel less and less genuine every time you answer it the same way. It's an incredible experience, and it's kind of why you make films too. So I've been incredibly grateful to Picture House, to Dog Wolf, to the BBC who commissioned the film, to all the people I work with, just to get it to this point where we can get it out.
Mm.
So even though the process is slightly exhausting, it's really wonderful to be doing this.
I think a film like Whitney as well, meeting the audience straight afterwards, it's quite an emotional story, and there was times when I was in tears, and obviously it ends on quite a sad note.
I was often in tears in the editing room.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I thought, you, Broomfield, are becoming an old softie. You know, what is going on here? Is it some genetic weirdness you're going through? And then I realized Mark was doing the same thing, but we were so English that we weren't really telling each other. And then we both talked about where we would get choked up in the film. Because, you know, the more we put Whitney into the film and the more you feel Whitney and this incredible spirit that that woman has still, the more emotional it is. And every time I see that film, I find myself just going emotionally. And that's also kind of what cinema, I think, is about.
Mm.
It's about going in and having your emotions taken somewhere. So you kind of, you're losing control in a way of a certain part of you. And it reminds you of just how human we are. And it's so wonderful to feel something so intensely, I think.
Absolutely, and I think also the shared environment in the cinema adds to that, and you're out of your comfort zone, and there are no distractions, in theory, as long as people aren't on their mobile phones.
That's true. I mean, the first time a wonderful friend of mine called Kelly Lee organized my first proper cinema screening, and I was sitting next to her, and I knew she had contact lenses, and she seemed to be constantly fiddling with her contact lenses. I thought, this is so annoying. What is she doing? You know, and then at one point I looked at her and I realized that she was just mopping the tears up.
Wow.
You know, and I was like, oh, you know, I suddenly realized the power that the film had, you know, and Kelly Lee said at the end, I'm so pleased the credits were so long. It just got me, I could just about get myself together by the end of the credits, you know.
That's important, and you must notice that coming in at the end of the film during the credits for Q&As, when you can probably still hear some of the audible sobbing.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's amazing to have made something that is so affecting, so moving, yeah.
I guess just going back to when you're editing and when you feel emotional, that must be a good sign. Like, you must definitely want to keep that bit in the film if that's having that effect on you after being with this for so long.
I guess so. It's kind of an emotion that I haven't trusted that much because I guess I'm not used to it that much. I mean, I felt very emotional making the Eileen film.
Mm.
You know, I had such a crazy connection to Eileen. I don't know where it came from, but she really touched my heart. And we had this communication. And when she was executed at the end of that film, I was really devastated for a very long time. I mean, you know, a couple of years probably. And this is probably the film that's kind of affected me the most on that kind of level of emotion. So it's kind of not a experience I have every day. And I was, and you know, I'm surprised at the power of it. So part of making the Whitney film was learning that kind of thing, which is a big learn, isn't it? And what I love about making films is you never stop learning. And I learned so much on this film, really. And Mark Hoffman cut the film, and we went through an incredible experience together, which neither of us were expecting. I think we're very happy. Although it was, a very tough edit, I felt much that I had learned so much that I was very grateful.
Just on I guess on the editing process, you used some really fantastic archive footage throughout the film, and I went on such a weird journey. I kept forgetting I was watching sort of archive footage, and it was like I was watching a fly on the wall camera crew just following Whitney through her life. And then occasionally, some part of my brain that watches films would be like, "Oh, look, this is in a different aspect ratio, or this is different film stock, or something." And I was like, "Oh yeah, like this is incredible that you've got this jigsaw piece of someone's life, like a real human being's life, and you've managed to piece it together in 100 minutes of cinema."
Yeah, that took a lot of doing to make it seamless. And of course, we were also incredibly lucky to get Rudy Dolezal on board, who's my co-director, who had shot 100 hours of footage with Whitney that had never been seen before. And who is so talented. He obviously was loved by Whitney and allowed in, even in the most sort of intimate and private moments, whether it was with Bobby or, where she comes off stage and for some reason she's just enveloped in tears and she sort of sits down and Rudy is able to observe it all. And I think we see sides of Whitney that no one's ever seen before. Or her relationship with Robin Crawford, which is such an amazing part of the story. Yes, and you try and put it all together in a kind of seamless story. And you're taken into this world, this amazing world, the world of Whitney Houston. And it is an incredible voyage.
What did, at the beginning of the process, I guess, what did the film, because I guess you have to take footage from here and from here and from here, and it must be lots of, in my head, just piles of tapes and film reels and discs and things.
You are right.
How do you sort of know what should go where?
It takes 2 years, because we had 80 hours of interviews that I had done, which you've got on transcripts. Then you have 100 hours of Rudy's footage, which was, of course, on a completely different... His footage was on Avid. Ours was on Premiere. And then there was probably another 50 to 80 hours of other archive from MTV, Channel 5 documentaries, you name it. We had it, all those old shows, from way back when, ancient footage of, anything we could get our hands on. That amazing footage that was shot with Sissy in the church. Mm. And there was obviously lots more of it. And I think the reason it takes so long is you have to sort of absorb it all into your subconscious, really. So you're fluent with it. And you have to know the interviews fluently. And then slowly, over months of editing, ideas come to you. And for me, annoyingly, the ideas tended to come between probably 4 in the morning and 7 in the morning, when my 4-year-old son would wake up and I'd have to get out of bed, sort of really not having slept. And I did think if I carried on editing much longer, I would just go mental because I was sleeping so little and I was so immersed in the film that... And you do have your best ideas then, but it is, it is exhausting. And then I just had to sort of try and rinse it all out of my head to get on to the next one, you know, get on with something else.
The biggest challenge is having that idea in the morning and then actually remembering it still when you get into work or whatever.
Well, what I always do is either have a notepad next to my bed or my phone, and I just would put notes in there. But that means, of course, you wake up each time and otherwise I find I can't go back to sleep because I think I'll forget the idea before the morning. And you inevitably do.
Mm.
And some of the ideas are really good, actually, unfortunately. You get to a point where you wish the ideas were really bad, and then you can just go back to sleep and not think about them anymore.
Of course. I often have them at the beginning of a film screening, like just as the logo comes up for the film company. And then the challenge is, because I do respect, you know, the not turning your phone on in the cinema, remembering it for 2 hours or maybe
right.
longer during the film. Like, what did I need to do? Oh, dear.
Yeah, or just get a pad and scribble it in there. I think actually, phones are so indiscreet, aren't they, with that screen.
It's like setting off like turning a torch on in the middle of the cinema and it just goes...
No, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's awful when people do that. Yeah, I think at night it's much better that you just have a pencil and a pad of paper and you just scroll across it because you can normally read it in the morning. Sometimes I'm just not that organised, though. Yeah.
I'm curious with Whitney, what was your sort of first cut like? Because it sounds like you have so many hundreds of hours of footage to go through. Can you remember how long that first assembly was?
Well, I can actually. It was over 2 hours, and it really didn't work. That's what I really remember more than anything. It was like there was a lot of footage. The order was obviously very different from now. And I got to the end of the film, viewed the film, and it was just like, so what? It was kind of like, yes, okay, we've got through the life.
Mm.
We've got from A to Z, but I feel nothing. And I was pretty frustrated. And this was before Mark Coughlan came on board. And I called him up. Mark normally lives in Kenya. He's married to a Kenyan woman, and they live in Nairobi. And I called him up. I said, look, I'm kind of going nuts here. I've got this enormous film. It's not working. I don't feel anything. It's sort of, and I remember the BBC, wanted to watch the film. And I spent 5 minutes just slagging the film off. I said, it's terrible. It's not working. I was like just fuming about the film, really. And anyway, Mark came over and we watched it on the plane, and Mark said, what's missing is Whitney. You made a film about Whitney, but Whitney's really not in the film and you don't know what she's thinking. You don't hear her voice. And, we've got to be with Whitney. And so we kind of recut the film. It took like maybe 7 months to do. And we put her voice in.
Mm.
We put that incredible performance of I Will Always Love You at the beginning where you just, you just see Whitney really go through it and she just pulls you on board.
Mm.
And then I think every step of the way we tried to work out where her mind was at, and I think by the end of the film now you're so with Whitney that that's what brings the emotion. It sounds like an incredibly obvious thing, but the more that person is in the film. And of course it was a very different way of making a film to my other films, where I was more the narrator and stuff. So this is like, it was also like, get yourself out of the film, Broomfield. This is not your film. You're not fucking interesting here. We want Whitney. And, so it was a great relief, actually, to cut myself out. And originally, the BBC in particular, I think, wanted more of me. They thought the problem it wasn't working was because I said, no, this is, I'm, you know. And the next time it came back, there was none of me in it at all. They said, what have you done? You know, not only you not ignored our notes, but you got in the opposite direction. I said, yeah, this is the way it's got to be. And it, you know, it worked. Of course, they were very supportive of it then because I think they saw exactly where it was going. But it was, yeah, that was a big thing. It was a big thing and a very creative thing. And I, you know, enjoyed it. And I learned a lot by doing it so differently.
I think it's good sometimes to get a second pair of eyes or a second opinion from someone who...
I think we had 100 pairs of eyes on this one because we had so many screenings and so many opinions. Mm. And some people are quite brutal in their criticism, you know. They're not staggeringly helpful. And you have to sort of get a pretty thick skin to deal with it, you know, and sort of laugh it off. But also, sometimes there's some real truth there and you have to, like, although you're initially really pissed off with them and you have to sort of bite your tongue not to say something, sometimes if you sleep on it for a couple of days and dare to come back to their really insulting comments, there's something there, you know, that you can use. It's all about using it, you know, so. And not... The only trouble is, you know, people tend to see a film once and they think that's the film.
Mm.
They don't really understand how much a film can change in a period of time. And I think what a lot of people do is they stop editing too soon. You know, editing, I always think, is you need to be in there and you need to go on and on and on and on and on because a film changes so radically towards the end. You know, the whole tone can change. Everything will change. And this film changed massively. And I think just getting the information on the titles right, which again sounds simple, is actually a really complicated job between, like, not giving enough, giving too much, simplifying them, finding some kind of form and order. Because, you know, films are quite formal. And... you know, all those things and getting the right music composed. It's all a massive, it makes such a difference to, all those little bits make such a difference to a film. And you need to just stay with it until you get it right, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I think audiences in cinemas this weekend will appreciate your hard work because it is a really moving story. And you're right about the titles at the end; like they're so important for you know, giving you something before you leave the cinema to sort of think about. And,
yeah.
And I mean, I was looking things up online afterwards because I wanted to know more about this amazing person.
Yeah, exactly. And Nick Lea Clouse did an amazing score at the end.
Mm.
Which he only actually had 3 weeks to do it in. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, he wrote all the music that isn't Whitney's in the film.
Mm. It blends in so well, and it really does complement the picture.
Yeah, it's very emotional.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for talking
pleasure.
To us today, Nick. Pleasure to screen the film. Fingers crossed for it all. And thanks for coming out to our cinemas and supporting. It's great.
It was great. Yeah. I'll be keeping my fingers crossed.
You have been listening to the Picture House Podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening and see you next week.